You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, everyone. This is Jonathan Ryan. I'm one of the co-founders of Sick Pilgrim, the online community that's sweeping.
Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, as we're here every time we do this podcast, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today we got a very interesting guest. His name is John Sweeney. He's an independent scholar, one of religion's most respected writers. He's been hailed by everybody from Booklist to Fox News, and he's been interviewed on CBS Saturday Morning and Fox and a bunch of other different places. And he's got a new book out, which I thought would be interesting to discuss, called The Saint Versus the Scholar, talking about a fascinating and unfortunately now forgotten chapter in the church's history and in medieval history about a conflict between one of the great saints of the period and one of the great scholars of the period. Welcome, Mr. Sweeney. How you doing?
Well, thanks, Mark. It's fun to be with you.
Yeah. What prompted you to write The Saint Versus the Scholar?
I love taking episodes, characters, situations, movements from the late Middle Ages, and bringing them to life and showing how they are relevant and we still live with them today. So the way in which I've done that the most in the past is I've written several books about St. Francis of Assisi and St. Clair and the early Franciscans, and that's been a real passion of mine for about 15 years. Okay. And then I wrote a book called The Pope Who Quit about the 13th century Pope St. Celestine V, who became the real precedent for the whole idea that a pope could quit. And so, you know, I love taking those kinds of episodes and characters and bringing them to life. And I thought this was an example of a situation, a conflict, a couple of characters that should be brought to life because we still live with what happened between them.
Okay. Is it? I remember reading there's a story about Charles Williams, the English writer who's a friend of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien's. And there's a story that mentions that he was getting his hair cut. And the barber, while he was cutting his hair, was remarking that when I'm with my girl, she just makes me want to be a better person. And Williams jumped out of his chair and shook the man's hand and said, "That's exactly the way Dante felt."
So Charles Williams was living with Dante that closely, is what you're saying?
Oh yeah, he was a great student of Dante's and a huge fan, as they would call him today.
Right.
But that ability to look into the past and see contemporary things in episodes that, you know, it's been famously said that the past is another country.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
People have this notion that, what does Bernard of Clairvaux have to do with me? He lived a long time ago and who cares? And he spoke Latin.
Right.
Is this a book that is going to appeal to history junkies, or did you have a bigger audience in mind?
Oh, definitely a bigger audience. And, you know, William Faulkner said something like, "The past isn't even past." I never want to only appeal to history junkies. At least I try to write a story like this so that it will draw in anyone who has a sort of serious interest in understanding where we come from and what the church is all about and what theology has always concerned itself with and what, in this case, you know, these two types, the saint and the scholar, where they came from.
Tell us a little bit about Bernard and Peter Abelard.
Well, Peter was the first of the great philosophers in the Middle Ages at the University of Paris. He was one of the first, sort of the founder of the scholastic method that then Thomas Aquinas made much more common and popular and standard in the church and in the catechism. In Peter's day, it was very, very fresh, the whole idea of reaching back to Aristotle and to other pagan and other philosophers and pulling their ideas into theology.
But this is about the mid-1100s, right?
Well, Peter was born 1079, 1080. The episode that I talked the most about in the book was in 1140. That's the general time.
Okay.
But the best way to understand Peter, really, I think the only way to understand Peter is that he was handsome. He was kind of debonair. He was brilliant. He was argumentative. He was a debater, you know, without peer. And he was almost like, I mean, it's hard to imagine this given the distance from the 12th century to the 21st, but he was almost like what today would be sort of a rock star. I mean, if you can imagine in sort of popular culture, the person who people emulate, respect, are sort of afraid of, are fascinated by, they want to find out every day what this person's doing. Peter Abelard was that kind of a figure in Paris. Long ago, it's hard to imagine that a philosopher could hold such a position, but that's who he was.
Well, it tells you something about the temper of the medieval mind, though, that he would be a rock star rather than a rock star being a rock star. You know?
Yes. Well, part of what I mean by that rock star analogy is that the young people, you know, the young right. who are attracted to these kinds of characters in particular, were very interested in Peter and everything he had to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this was a period that took very seriously the life of the mind. Which again, a lot, that's news, I think, for a lot of postmoderns, you know, those people, they lived in the dark ages, you know?
Yeah, right. Right. So, yes. Yes. They weren't so dark. I mean, I suppose, you know, if you think about the fact that they didn't have refrigeration and flushing toilets and things like that, it was dark. But you know, there was no cure for polio. So I mean, there were some things that were
right.
that were unfortunate. But yeah, there were many ways in which they were much more in the light than perhaps we are today.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and they were busy doing things like inventing the university and the hospital, and parliamentary government.
Yes. Yes.
And science. So talk a little bit then about what's going on in this period.
Well, there were all kinds of things that were going on that impacted the relationship between Peter and Bernard of Clairvaux. I set up my book actually in a way where I tell the story of the First Crusade and how that formed the generation immediately before the two of them. It formed their parents, essentially. So they grew up in a world which was all of a sudden quite different from the world that had been just a generation or two earlier, because it was the generation that had given birth to this idea that the leaders in the church and the not just the sort of princes and cardinals and so on, but every able-bodied Christian was supposed to march off to the east and retake the Holy Land. And this became a very violent time that then was mixed up with magisterium at the same time. So it became kind of a confusing time and a time when power and influence began to take on a whole new tone. And these two guys, Peter and Bernard, wielded power and influence in very distinct ways.
Talk a little bit about Bernard. I mean, Bernard preached the Crusades.
Bernard preached the Crusades. Bernard was the ultimate insider. He was a saint. Mm-hmm. He was also one of the most powerful figures in the church. He was the abbot at Clairvaux. He was one of the reformers of the Cistercian order, and he was a man of really profound theological insight, spiritual insight, and mystical relationship with God. And I say that last bit because it's essential to understand who Bernard was. He wasn't just a theologian. I mean, it's perfectly great to be a theologian, but he was also someone who, for instance, preached more than 80 sermons on the Song of Songs, interpreting it in a way that is still studied today by seminary students and university students as one of the most beautiful works of devotional, mystical Christian literature ever written. Mm-hmm. And it came from a relationship that he had. I mean, it came out of a real depth inside of him. So anyway, he was a counselor to cardinals and popes, and then he actually ended up playing a key role in choosing the next pope, and he was a former student of his. So that's who Bernard was. He was this ultimate insider and reformer within the church.
Okay. And I think it is important to make that clear that this is when you have a book with a title like The Saint versus the Scholar, to a postmodern audience, a lot of people are going to hear in that the obscurantist versus the thinker. Mm. and that's not what you're saying. But that's what a postmodern audience often tends to hear because, particularly here in the United States, you get the kinds of, the Bill Maher versus the creationist types, and those kinds of culture war arguments, very, very debased, I think, culture war arguments that go on. And it's important to grasp that we're talking about a time in which people really did take ideas very, very seriously. This was not... Wahoos versus right. thinkers and that kind of thing. And that leads to the next question, which is why is it important in the culture wars that we're living in today for religious people to have some kind of an understanding of what this controversy was about between Bernard and Peter Abelard?
Well, so to answer that question, I'm sort of cutting right to the essence, of the whole reason why I wrote the book, which is I think that we still live with the division that in many ways I think began with the conflict that took place between the two of them. I mean, in some ways I'm using that conflict as a way to raise this whole discussion. I mean, you could point to several other incidents throughout the history of the church where this also took place. But so, it's kind of convenient that I found one and I'm telling this story. But I think you can make the argument that going back to their century and their conflict, ever since then, we've had this division between faith and reason, mm-hmm. and which shouldn't be there. And that the point I make in the book is that division that took place and that we still live with in many ways was a product of the two personalities that were involved in the fight. Mm-hmm. Because these two men actually shared a whole lot. As you've mentioned, they shared living in a time when these ideas and who God is and what God's relationship to the universe is and what we can say about God and what we cannot say about God and how theology relates to all of the other aspects of human knowledge. I mean, this was an era when they certainly shared a worldview where all of that was common between them. But right. But they came at it from such different perspectives, and they criticized each other in ways that have become so stereotyped as the saint versus the scholar. Mm-hmm. So... anyway, that's kind of cutting to sort of the end of why I wrote the book and why I think it's important today.
Well, and I think that you're absolutely right. This is one of the great achievements that Thomas Aquinas brought to the discussion as well. Was he saw no conflict between faith and reason, because all truth is God's truth. And we can certainly speak of, you know, we can speak of natural revelation and supernatural revelation, but those things are not contradictory in Thomas's mind, nor in the mind of the tradition, of course. Which brings me to another question. In this debate, you know, some people call it a war, which drives me nuts. between faith and there is not a war between faith and reason. Right. But is there a third way that we can take in approaching this?
Well, there is, and I think the way to get to that third way is to look at the ways in which power and influence became too important to both the saint, because Bernard was a saint, there's no question about it, and to someone like Peter Abelard, who was not an awful person. I mean, this was a man who wrote a commentary on the book of Ezekiel. You don't do such things if you are, you know, consumed with unedifying thoughts and so on. And when Bernard was condemning Peter's writings and organizing a conference of bishops to do the same, many of the writings that were pointed to as Peter's, Peter said, well, I didn't actually write that. Someone says that I wrote that, because, I mean, back then, you know, it wasn't quite as discreet in terms of what was written and what was published and so on. I mean, often your students would write down things that you said, or they would write them down wrong, or they would compile a manuscript of things that you wrote and then throw in things that other people wrote, and it would get published under your name. And so it was much more confusing than was let on. But nevertheless, you know, Bernard took it upon himself to just simply said, you know, these are condemned, and to declare him a heretic, and to put a very fine point on what was a very messy situation. But anyway, all of that is to say, yes, I think there is a third way, and I think it can come with humility, which the two of them did not have. I mean, a person can be a saint and not be possessed of terrific humility, and I think Bernard of Clairvaux was probably such a person, because he went to great lengths to belittle his intellectual enemy in Peter, you know, and that's the way in which we get these two categories of saint and scholar. The saint says of the scholar, he doesn't have any care for tradition. He doesn't have any care for the magisterium. He's like a devil lurking in the grass. And then the scholar says of the saint things like, he's just a puppet for what the cardinals want him to say. so they push each other off to the margins in a way that you can't find that sort of third way. So I try and point to Hildegard of Bingen, who was their contemporary, and who of course has recently become a saint and a doctor of the church.
Right.
And she actually had correspondence with Bernard of Clairvaux. And when you look at the way in which she wrote with Bernard back and forth, the humility of it is really striking and beautiful, particularly compared to the relationship between these two guys. Mm-hmm. And if I may suggest, you know, sometimes I think a woman can find the way when two men simply cannot, because I think men, and I'm included in this, get a little caught up in what we think and who we are and how we sound when we say it and all of that sort of thing. And sometimes, you know, women don't get as caught up in that as we do. And when you look at Hildegard, she had this beautiful, humble way of saying to Bernard in a letter, would you just tell me, you know, be sort of a sounding board for me and tell me if I'm on the right track. I'm having these visions, I'm having these ideas. Am I on the right track? And Bernard responded to her in kind and confirmed that he really believed that she was, and that these were messages from God. But the way that she approached things, the humility that she had, is a striking corrective, I think, to the way that Bernard and Peter dealt with each other.
Interesting. You know, what this sounds like to me, of course, this is also one of the weird and amazing ways that the medieval period spills over into the present, is this sounds like the internet. You know, I see this kind of stuff all the time, of course, with the, you know, of heroic defenders of what people think is the church. And, you know, you get the other side of it, too. You know, the academic snob, who kind of a pain, you know.
Yes.
And that kind of thing that goes on. Yeah, yes. It really does sound like, and even the inability to determine the provenance of writings is becoming, you know, as we're seeing now, you know, on the internet, there are people who literally their job is to, the way they make money is to sit down and just make up news. Uh-huh. Literal fake news, you know, just deliberately tell lies and attribute it to all kinds of sources, and the ability to vet that kind of information is becoming again just as much a problem now as it was in Bernard's day.
Yeah, you know, I actually hadn't thought of that parallel, and you're exactly right. I mean, I just had an instance on social media the other day, a religious writer who I read a lot and who I know well, and There's someone on Twitter whose job apparently is to throw a quote out every day, or I don't know, every hour perhaps, from this writer. And there was a quote that I read and I thought, that sure does not sound like this writer that I know. And so I quickly responded and said, give me a source, please, because this sure does not sound like something he would say.
Right.
You know, I mean, this kind of thing happens all the time. And yes, and I think it's going to become fuzzier and fuzzier. We're sort of rushing headlong back towards the Middle Ages, I guess.
Yeah, it's a very curious thing that the institutions that used to be in place, very briefly, for about a century or so, when media were controlled, as Chesterton said, they were the playthings of a few rich men,
mm-hmm.
and therefore could fairly reasonably vet their sources, although even then it was still often a crapshoot. But a lot of that's going away now.
Yes.
And it was a problem for most of human history, and it was a problem in Bernard's day. Did Peter write this? Well, somebody told me he did.
Right. Right. My students highlighted these things in a manuscript and told me that they were Peter's, and so they're condemned.
Yeah, right. So that's interesting as well. There's a real ring of tension. This is a story about a fight. And so there's tension, in this book. How adversarial, are the events that you're describing in this book?
Well, the primary event was this council that Bernard organized in 1140 in order to condemn the writings of Peter. And it was quite adversarial. And if you can, you know, think back to the two characters in the way that I described them, you have Bernard already there with all the bishops around him. And then you have Peter enter the room, and you have Peter's fans, quite literally, you know, the 20-year-olds outside the gates cheering for him. Because he was this, you know, pop star. And Peter kind of swaggers in, and Bernard has already sort of swaggered into his chair of authority. And Bernard and all of the bishops, one by one, damn the writings. And Peter stands up, sort of refusing to accept their conclusions or to even debate them, because the scholar doesn't think it's even necessary to debate the saint.
Right.
And says, well, I'm headed off to Rome and I'll go see the Pope and he'll set things straight. And nothing got set straight after that. But those two personalities were headlong, you know, destined to conflict with each other based on a whole bunch of things that happened before and after.
Uh-huh. Is this simply a conflict about ideas? Is there also...
No, not at all.
They just didn't like each other.
They didn't like each other. That's one of the things I want to come through in this book is the fact that, you know, we often sort of assume that these debates, that these conflicts, even, you know, all of the occasions through history when someone's been declared a heretic, that it's a question of ideas and one set of ideas being ruled as truth over another set of ideas. But that's a very inaccurate way to look at what often happens. It's often a conflict of personalities. And so, I was just going to say, and so in the latter part of the book, one of the things I have is I have a chapter where I talk about Abelard's surprising sensitivity to matters of faith. And I talk about Bernard's beautiful kind of surprising attention to the love of God, because our image of him, as you said at the outset, is that he was the preacher of the Crusades. Right. So there's these ways in which they didn't even know each other, really, right, in the ways that they could have known each other and they could have avoided some of this fight.
C.S. Lewis once remarked that the ancient Persians used to debate things twice, once when they were sober and another time when they were drunk. And there's often a sense that I have when once the heat of passion has died away and, you know, the historical circumstances are forgotten, and you come back and you encounter these characters and you find yourself thinking, you know, they might have been friends had things been different. I like both of these people.
Right.
It's too bad that they couldn't see each other, you know, the way I see them. And I do get that sense sometimes, you know. I remember reading an essay by Garrison Keillor where he talked about visiting the battlefield at Gettysburg and walked across the great field where Pickett's charge took place and tried to imagine what would drive somebody to march into that kind of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And tried to imagine, you know, why would something like states' rights, which is now like this abstraction that you read about in a history textbook, how could this move men to die by the thousands? You know, why would somebody do that?
Right.
And you read these kinds of stories of these historical controversies, and it is difficult, I think, for postmodern people to look back at a controversy like this and imagine why it would elicit such passions, and yet it did. And so I'm grateful to you for writing The Saint versus the Scholar so that you can get to know these guys and who they were.
Well, thanks. I think it is an important story that we still live with, and we can still get better at bridging these two, you know, types, these two ways of approaching faith.
Yeah, because it's a controversy that's still very much with us in that way, and we see it still all the time. Where can people find your book?
All the usual places, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and the Catholic bookstores are always good to me. So, you know, all the usual places.
All right. Very good. Well, John Sweeney, I want to thank you so much for being on Connecting the Dots today. And best wishes on your book. I hope you sell a million.
It's fun. It's been fun, Mark. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.